How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
April 1968. I went downtown for tea to the Palmer House this day, Sunday, as I usually do. Although the riots have made white people so nervous that few are venturing into this city where they might encounter black people, I admit it is unnerving. On the L, a group of young black men stared at me and my two companions, also white, with what I must say seemed overtly ruthless hatred. I was glad that Zoe and Howard had come with me. I should have gone for tea regardless, but Howard, sweet boy, insisted on going with me as my gallant. And Zoe, who simply delighted with the idea of it, having never had an English high tea, insisted on coming too. Even that disturbing encounter on the train, which I have described, she found exhilarating, astonished that such emotion should be directed toward her, naive, innocent. Howard said he understood how these young blacks felt. He should have joined them in the riots himself, were he black. The worst of the riots occurred just west of where we disembarked, up West Madison. Many of the hundreds of buildings that had been torched by arson were still smoldering, black, and chemically odorous smoke drifting grimly in places still plumes above their charred ruins. A span of over 24 city blocks just across the Chicago River from where we stand is cadaverous and ghastly. It reminds me of London during the Blitz. Barricades are set across the bridge as we look west, where we see the National Guard and Army troops posted with automatic rifles, hundreds of soldiers prepared to kill citizens as would-be enemies. Thousands have been arrested, mostly youthful black males, housed in makeshift detentions, formerly their own high school gymnasiums. Such hysterical violence as this occurred like an outbreak of virus sweeping the nation, maddening 100 cities in just one night, the night of King's murder, Minneapolis, Madison, Gary, Washington, D.C., so many American cities. It is the endemic outrage of desperation and despair, of anger and hopelessness. What else is to be done but to destroy ourselves? The blacks shall suffer more than the whites. It is they who are harmed most by their rage. There is no electrical power in their portions of the city. It is their homes, their businesses that are burning. Mayor Daley, responding as much to his predilection as political will, sent roving masses of his white police, some 10,000 upon the streets with orders of shoot to kill. 11 blacks have been killed. Hundreds have been injured. Some by the police, some by their own kind. A self-inflicted mayhem. Violence seems quelled, but thousands of blacks are now homeless and wandering. Standing before its magnificent gilded lobby, under the brazen Beaux-Arts porch to the Palmer House, we still smell the stinging tear gas deployed against them, thrown to keep the blacks from penetrating these districts where the whites live and have dominion. 11 April 1968. Call it guilt, call it justice, call it too late. The president signed the Civil Rights Act today. Howard cannot speak about the assassination without bitter emotion. I recall my own stunned despondency during the war, when so many were suddenly killed by bombing and there seemed no hope, no end to it. The darkest hour, as Winnie called it. My attempts to console him with the salve of that recollection did not soothe him, nor me. For it sometimes seems mankind learns nothing from experience and is doomed to perpetuate ignorance and cruelty. Zoe is the loveliest flower of my garden. She is my salient orchid, lithesome, lushly colorful, delicate in features, profound in her effect on me. Like that improbable exotic which thrives on mere air, and her charm and beauty, like that of the orchid, is effortless and insouciant. They all, mes fleurs de chardon mystique, as I call my girls, the multiples, who are the subject of my research now, are the self-heal that Howard and I need. Zoe, especially, whom I have taken to nurture, offering that she come to live here with me, not being able to afford her own apartment should she be so intensely engaged by our research, and having need to forsake her working hours accordingly. I wish, besides, to encourage her study of classical Greek and to facilitate her development intellectually. This is such help as I once generously received from a gentle mentor as a girl, and we should always return to the others in the world the grace and gifts given so gladly to ourselves, to replenish them, to keep the circulation of the goodness going well and strong, I think. One curious question to put to our subjects, based upon the data collected, shall be the problem of identity, the sense of personal self. When leaving the body, the experience of the separated mind is thought to be the actual self. The self is where the percipient is located. This point of space of perception is the person of the self, the person who owns the life and identity in question. But who or what is that other thing, that seemingly inert body over there? If this disembodied, floating entity is the true self, then is that body over there merely a vehicle for life and not part of oneself? I do not pose this for a philosophical puzzle. It is absurdly posed, of course. But I want to understand the experience, how it is conceived, explained, and interpreted by the subject, as matter of perception, as it were by casual and implicit philosophy of experience. The exomatic experience is of two phenomenal types. One, a parasomatic experience, in which the percipient conceives himself as in a separate person or body, non-physical and immaterial as it may be. And two, an asomatic experience, that is, the percipient is conscious and present in space, as it were, without a body. In parasomatic experience, percipients insist with some astonishment that their immaterial presence seems to replicate the body in all appearance. They can see and sense their familiar hands before them, see a familiar torso beneath them, cast their gaze as with ordinary eyes. They sometimes even wear familiar clothing. Oddly, No one has reported viewing this entity in a mirror, something that must be tried. On the other hand, in the asomatic type of report, which are the most common, about 80% of the cases, that is when the percipient does not see or sense a separate body or being, but rather feels disembodied, these reporters do not usually think they lack a body. Although that term is sometimes used by them and used by me expressly, but see as by a camera, like many a dream. They are separate from their bodies, but not an entity apart, or so they perceive. They retain identification with what they conceive to be their real body, which, nonetheless, they typically may see lying, sitting, standing physically elsewhere, over there, as it were, in the normal spatial perception. But while they perceive that their consciousness is located remotely from their own body, and apparently separated from it, they do not perceive the place whereat their perception floats to be a separate body, per se. Or at least, they do not remember thinking it is so. They perceive themselves to be at a point of perception, afloat at a point of space, removed from their real body, which is over there. One respondent called this perception a pinpoint of presence. The sensation of bilocation, of being two entities in two places at once, one in mid-space, bodiless or not, and one remaining in the normal physical state, entails considerable difficulty to express. In one instance, told with baffled wonderment, one of our multiples said that on the first occasion that she confronted her own body, lying apart from herself, she did not recognize herself, but saw her body lying among some other girls sleeping in a tent, as it were a stranger, whom she examined curiously. Our words fail us. Our conventional construction collapses. Of course, few of us are aware of the multiplicities or simultaneities in our consciousness, although we should understand this to be our normal condition. But rather we conceive and perceive consciousness as serially, even linearly, arising attentions, one after another, this here, then that, and so on. Some respondents speak of a bi-local self. They tell me that they discuss things with their bodies. For example, quarreling about the urgency of returning to the body, something the body seemed very anxiously to favor. Others speak of oscillating between points in space or flipping in and out of their bodies. Yet another respondent described astonished discovery of her own body, saying excitedly to herself, "Oh, there is me," perceiving her own body, and then immediately also saying with amusement to herself, "But I'm here," acknowledging the point in space from which she viewed her body. Thus the dualistic I and me in our minds, and fortunate to our linguistics, the reflexive self me, the one upon which the world happens and who acts in self-defense or self-interest, versus the principal self I, the self aloof of self, observer, that which is conscious of its own consciousness. Dr. Singh explained this to me with precise terms of Hindu mysticism, of course. Jung might speak of it as shadow and anima. I do not own any particular paradigm for a description of the matter at this time. That this bi-local self is integrated, by the way, should be evident in that while the body, per se, does not recall what it is doing during exomatic states, even if active, the activity of the floating self, out there, is recalled perfectly. Therefore, the brain in that body later recalls the events that occurred whilst out of the body. Thus, though disconnected, the two selves are somehow linked. Some say they see a sort of silvery, ropey line between them, umbilical-like. But out of their backsides, connected to their bodies, as it were, tethering them, rather like Mr. Kubrick's spacemen in the void. But this is an uncommon observation. In all events, something happening to the body can and will bring the two selves jolted back together. Gross sensations or anxiety, or as in one reported episode from one of our older multiples, by a strong physical emotion. She said, I had drifted into a movie theater because I wanted to see the movie, but had not time with all the studies I had to do, papers to grade and so on. But here I found I was seated, floating, really, over the heads of the people, and strangely, because I have poor eyes and must wear very thick lenses, I found it very easy to see it, even though obviously I was not wearing my glasses. It was quite a funny movie, The Producers. You should go see it, if you have not done so. I would gladly go again. Anyway, when the scantily clad chorus girls began dancing in campy Nazi uniforms and singing Springtime for Hitler, I just burst out laughing immediately. And I found myself sitting up, back in bed, laughing out loud. I wished I could go back to see the rest of the movie, but I had to go buy a ticket like an ordinary person. Evidently, laughter is the stuff of which the body is made. 1 May, 1968. Sois-je étais-toi. I am playing hooky. My students here have also done. Because it is May Day. Because it is warm and lovely. Because my daffodils are blooming against the garden wall in their cozy bed. When all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze, continuous as the stars that shore and twinkle in the Milky Way. They stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. Zoe persuaded me to take this carefree holiday. It is May Day, and I have told her stories of that my mother told me, how as a child her father took her in his arms and leapt with her across the great bonfire for Beltane, Gwalgalan May. Three times he leapt. It was the custom for good luck. I am taking my elevenses in my gazebo in my garden. Bugger is rubbing himself against my legs fervently, and purrs loudly before I can even pet him. My tea is delicious, with a clover honey and good clotted cream, and I have put a few sweet meal digestives on my saucer to nibble. I love this garden. The birds chirp song that's meant for me. My cat purrs on my lap. I love my garden. My backyard is enclosed by a high brick wall, and an iron door at a rear gated entrance, rather like the homes I remember in the better parishes of Belfast, like my own childhood home. It was for this semblance, I think, I was enchanted to buy this place, for I could scarce afford it when I was an associate professor. I recreated a classic English garden here, with gazebo for taking my teas in the quiet contemplation, and birdhouses for my guest wrens and the dear English sparrows so familiar to me. A lovely old basswood centrally shades the lawn and the garden, but the borders are sunny enough for roses, which I have planted in plenty. Protected by the wall, it seems cutting them back is sufficient to keep them through the inclement winters. I read my papers in the dappled light. The light breeze plays upon the pages. A musical called Hair has opened on Broadway, in which the cast appears nude on stage and sings hopefully of the dawning of an age of Aquarius, a time of harmony and understanding, sympathy and trust abounding, Zoe explains to me. All the same, the war continues as I read, and student protesters at Columbia University in New York City took over administration buildings and shut down the university. Finally, violently expelled from the president's office just yesterday. The Guardian reports that students in Paris have taken to the streets. In a conscious reconstruction of La Commune de Paris of 1871. Again, the same class warfare, the same political and social themes, sexual liberty, feminism, communism, the struggle against patriarchy, demands for gender equality, wage equality. In 1871, they also wanted the right of divorce, since won. The right to educate women, since won. Suppression of the distinction between married women and concubines, a bittersweet victory, and the abolition of prostitution, not even seriously considered. Now the cry is for free love, egalite, liberté, sexuality. Also not new. Also not something that shall ever be won or ever lost. My mother, who was an occasional nudist in our garden enclave at home, spoke of the same thing, and I fear she found it more easily obtained than disposed. The students of France cuff their enemies with slogans, gaily shouted, just as our students do, but theirs seem more charming, I think. We spontane, they invent, and declare, the alarm clock rings, oh, the first humiliation of the day. They scrawl their graffiti on walls with colored chalks. They want to buy happiness, steal it, or il est interdit de interdire. One striking poster reads simply, vite. What is this revolution? It's global. It is youthful. It has the wall-like wind of world history behind it, inexorable but also circumstantial. A Mexican peasant, great-grandchildren of Zapata, liberal bourgeoisie in Prague, the cloyed baby boomers, and victimized blacks. Precious intellects of the Sorbonne, garbage men in Memphis. In what do they believe? It is sometimes an enemy they hate. It is sometimes inchoate. The revolutionaries of 1789 rededicated Notre Dame to the cult of reason. That did not take. But then again, neither did the Reign of Terror. What restless seeking will. Moral and spiritual yearning with economic need and material craving. Chains of tyrants, chains of society, and chains of self, all must be broken and cast off. Come, mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand, for the times they are changing. Zoe celebrates her life with joyous enthusiasm of a child, as she truly is, and as she says she always wants to be. She has come out bare-breasted in her underpants into my garden, sipping her teacup held prayerfully in her two hands, barefoot, stepping gingerly about my flower beds, leaning to gaze on my flowers. She is as pretty as they. Howard shall be here shortly, shall let himself in, and shall find her here, half-dressed. How sweet. Sois jeune et tais-toi.
Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.